doing this. They said when you got here, the whole thing started. I think you're the cause of all this. I think you're evil. Evil!
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Monsters, John. Monsters from the It.
I'll follow you through.
Swallow this.
The power of Christ compels you. The power of Christ compels you.
Have you ever heard of Candyman?
You love the cemetery, but you love to punish this jet.
It rubs the lotion on its skin or else it gets the hose again.
You don't know what death is.
This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation.
Messenger of God, you're doomed. We can stay here.
God is dead!
He is dead!
Satan lives!
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
The animals are contagious! What fire!
It's time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Secretary, the missiles are flying.
See me in hell, Mr. Thorne. Hell will shout out our sentence.
I can't lie to you about your choices, but you have my sympathies.
This little procedure is called making a head on a stick.
I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains.
There is no one watching out for us, Merrill. We are all on our own.
And there's no more room in hell for the dead who walk here.
The events of that day were to lead to the discovery of one of the most bizarre crimes in the annals of American history, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
She just goes a little mad sometimes. We all go a little mad sometimes.
Stop letting me live here! Shut the doors, my God! You gotta tell them! Silent Green is people!
You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to the outer limits.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. Okay, and with me in the state of Michigan,
this is Eric!
Eric, how's it going?
It's good. Sorry, I was just watching something with Vince McMahon, so I was inspired. I'm fine.
Excellent. And in the state of New York?
This is Mike.
Mike, how are you?
A little confused by Eric's exuberance.
That's all right. I'm confused by it, too.
And, and we have a Connecticut American.
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how are you?
I am great.
All right, very good. We do have another co-host, Abe. However, he was unable to make it tonight due to the oddness and availability of finding this film because of a special edition that's out right now that it's kind of difficult to get. But so he will join us next week since he cannot attend today because he has nothing to say. But before we get into the episode, a couple of house cleaning. First off, Eric, you do another podcast with your buddy Dan. What do you let folks know about that?
All right. This is a general interest podcast called The Askancity Podcast. That's spelled A-S-K-A-N-C-I-T-Y. You can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play.
And, Mike, you actually do another podcast about a show on Stars.
Yeah, recently we started up as a spinoff to Dark Discussions, searching for the American Gods podcast, which is now three episodes deep, and we'll probably continue for another five, which will run out the season, before we jump back into You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, the Game of Thrones podcast.
And you also do a genre book.
Yes, it's Unnatural Selections, www.unnaturalselections.com.
Okay, very good. And Chrissy, you do things.
I do, and you can learn more about me at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com.
Okay, and actually we here are darkdiscussions.com, and on the right side of the front page you can find links to Eric, Mike, and Chrissy's various other projects, as they just mentioned. Also on darkdiscussions.com, at the bottom of every page, you can find links to our email, our Facebook group, our Twitter, the RSS feed, and links to Stitcher and iTunes, and soon another little icon will appear to Google Play, since now we are on Google Play. Also at the top of the page, there's a big button for Patreon, and Patreon is a place where you can donate to the podcast. We don't ask that you do, but some of our listeners requested to do so. They wanted to help out and give back, so we put up a link to www.patreon.com/darkdiscussions, or just go to darkdiscussions.com and press the button, and you can donate money. And if you do donate money, for every $5 that you donate per month, you get to possibly choose a film for us to do. So, in other words, if you donate $15 for the month of May, you could choose three films for us to do, such as Killer Fish, The Babysitter, or Drive-In Massacre. Or you could choose Drive-In Massacre three times. And then at the end of the quarter, we will randomly pick from a figurative hat a choice from all the folks who have donated to the podcast and given us films that they would like us to do. And since not many people donate to the podcast, the chance that we will do your film or even pull your film is pretty high. So it is worth a shot. And also you do get some other goodies, including books and such for donations. So if you donate like $10 or $15, I think, you get a one-time choice of a book, which is a horror anthologies, which includes stories from Christy Schoonover and myself, Patrick Lacey, as well as famous directors such as Patrick Ray and Simon Rumley, and forewords by folks like the writer of Exists, such as Jamie Nash. So it's worth donating, but it's mostly to just help the podcast. But again, even more important would be just getting emails from folks to know what they think of the podcast. Or on iTunes, Mike, what can they do on iTunes?
They can go on iTunes, and I imagine Stitcher, and when it's available, Google Play, and give us a review. 5 stars is, of course, always nice. That helps our overall rating. But every review we get bumps us a little bit further up the list of horror-themed podcasts and allows other people to find us and discover us, and furthers our plans to eventually take over the world.
That's right. Now, a couple of things that we have going. We do have a new contest, which will end June, or the last day of June, which I think is June 30th, where what we are asking for is people to send us through email, darkdiscussions@aol.com, memes from the podcast. So funny lines that reappear often and whatnot. And for everybody who sends a meme to us that they hear from our podcast, will be entered in to win a horror anthology similar to the ones from Patreon, because two of our listeners, Sean Fox and Chris Genro, have both donated a total of four books. So we will have four winners after June 30th. Now, Mike, there's conventions that you're going to.
If you've been a long-time Dark Discussions listener, you know that we've been supporters of the charity Scares of Care for a while. They've been good to us. They gave us interviews way back when we did our first interviews at Horror Realm in 2011. We've kept in touch ever since, and I've gotten to know its founder fairly well. And I'll be going back there for their Scares of Care weekend. It's more of a considered a charity fundraising event rather than a convention, but it's more or less a convention. And you can go there and meet lots of guests. Sid Haig and Kane Hodder, who will also be at ScareCon, they're at every convention. They got a lot of others this year. Like Jeffrey Combs is going to be there. They just recently announced Julian Sands from Warlock, and I think the female lead from that film. The two villains, or two main villains from Children of the Corn, will be there doing a photo op. The tall ginger kid, you know, Outlander, that kid, he'll be there. Although he's not a kid anymore. And the other one who looks like a mini Ted Cruz, he's going to be there too. So it's going to be a lot of fun. And one of the things that we're going to do to try to raise some funds for them this year is we are going to be selling a T-shirt for about a month. It's on the front, it's a green ghost design that says Dark Discussions Podcast. And on the back of the T-shirt is the Scares the Care logo saying we support Scares the Care. All the proceeds, every single penny from the proceeds will be going directly to Scares the Care. I'm hoping to have that set up. I just need the official word from founder Joe Ripple that we can use his logo, which I have unofficially. He just has to send me the email, which then I can give to the company that makes the T-shirts. And every penny of that will be going to the charity. And I want everyone to know that the charity itself, everyone there is a volunteer. No one takes a penny from that. All the money, obviously they have to pay for overhead and things, but outside of that, all the money goes to the people that they're supporting and the families that they're giving to. And you could go to their website, scaresofcare.org, to learn more about who they're supporting this year. The shirt sales will be up, like I said, hopefully by Memorial Day weekend. I'm hoping sooner than that. And there'll be it's the same design, but you can get it in a regular unisex men's tee in black, unisex men's tee in purple, just to throw some color in there, but also a black hoodie, pullover hoodie, and two women's style tees, fitted tees. So one is a crew neck and one is a V-neck. So there's a lot of options there for you want to do it. It's going to be $25 for the shirts, $35 for the hoodie. And as long as we get, I think it's 18, then the shirts will be printed and sent out somewhere around end of June, first week of July. What also I'm doing is going to be giving, personally, I'm donating two tickets to Scares the Care weekend, which is July, I think it's 22nd, 23rd, 24th in Williamsburg, Virginia. So anyone who buys apparel through the drive will be have their name entered and get a chance to win the two tickets, and the two tickets will be emailed to you. If you do not want the tickets because you won't be able to make it and want to pass, you can just leave a note when you make your purchase. But for every person who makes a purchase, your name will be put in the hat.
Very good. And Eric, we're doing something. The whole podcast is doing something in August, I think.
We are. Before I get to that, I just wanted to tack on a little bit to the Scares the Care thing. Every year, Mike puts a fair amount of effort into doing fundraising on behalf of Dark Discussions for the Scares the Care. So I wanted to thank him for that. I was able to go last year, and I had a really good time. Did not meet a single person at this place that I did that I thought was a jerk. Everybody was awesome.
Hey, what about me?
I said you're awesome. I don't think I've ever witnessed anybody with as much energy as Joe, who runs the thing. He's amazing, and I admire the work he does for this charity. It's good stuff, and I'm kind of bummed that I'm not going to make it this year. Hopefully next year I'll be able to get back there. Mainly I just wanted to thank Mike for all of his efforts, because I know it takes a lot of time and probably a little bit of money as well to get all this up off the ground.
Very
so,
good.
In August, your fearless co-host will be converging upon Mystic, Connecticut on August 21st, which is a Monday. So we will be there. We will be all getting together, perhaps watching a movie at the theater, depending on what's going on at that point, if it's something we might like to cover. I think we're definitely planning on recording a podcast while we're all in the same location. And also just hanging out, seeing what's up in Mystic, Connecticut. And we would love for some of our listeners to come out and meet us there. So if you're interested, make your plans now. August 24th in Mystic, Connecticut. We'd love to see you there.
All right. Very good. Yeah, that's right. And we hope to have anybody show up and everybody show up. If you do, you can email darkdiscussions@AOL.com and we will give you all the details. And also recommend hotels and local train or airport and so forth if that happens to be how you would come. But just not just for us, but just the whole area of that part of the state of Connecticut. It is a beautiful area, a very wonderful tourist place. And it also has two large casinos, Mohegan Sun and
Foxwoods.
Foxwoods, which the whole place, Mystic, is no further than 2 hours away from New York City and the city of Boston, and less than an hour away from the city of Providence, Rhode Island. and about an hour and a half from Hartford, Connecticut, or maybe even an hour. So a lot of easy places to fly to, and the train from New York City and Boston go right, or at least New York City goes right by it. So again, darkdiscussions@aol.com for further details. And Jessica Herrera, Abe Spinney will be there. So, hint, hint. Now, what else? I think that was it to do with that. But there was two deaths. The first was Powers Booth, and the second was Chris Cornell.
I don't know if that's relevant to this podcast.
That's true. That's right. Yes, yeah, they both passed away. But
I think it's significant enough. But hey, we acknowledge Prince, right? When he died, I mean,
yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true. So, but yeah, Powers Booth, a large genre actor, MTV and films, passed away unfortunately at the age of 68, and the musician Chris Cornell passed away at the age of 52. And for folks who have any thoughts of depression, suicide.org has links to every nation's hotline for help. So,
yeah, that's kind of unfortunately relevant that we just did an episode on 13 Reasons Why.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. So it's a big hot topic right now. A lot of schools have been sending home stuff. We've even had "quote unquote" progressives attack the show and the artist who made the show, as well as the writers and the writer of the original novel, which was quite surprising to me because you should never blame a artist for their work if it's not offensive. And this show, if anybody has seen it, would agree that it's actually very helpful more than offensive. You would agree with
that? I actually
got
some direct feedback from one of our listeners about our 13 Reasons Why episode. I'm not going to say who it is or what they said. But I just wanted to note that that show is affecting people. And it is a topic that that really hits home with some.
Yeah, there was actually a couple of folks that gave us good feedback on the Dark Discussions podcast Facebook group too, but I didn't have it queued up to read, which was probably stupid of me, but maybe next week. And it was some good feedback. Mike, you were gonna say something?
Oh, I was just gonna say that as a teacher, I've certainly heard a lot about it, and showing that teachers are no better than anyone else when it comes to talking about something that they have no idea what it is they're talking about.
There you go.
Because you're getting a lot of people who are complaining about how horrible the series is that they haven't watched.
Ah, yes.
I haven't watched it. I'm not going to comment because I haven't watched it. I haven't listened to your podcast either, so I have no idea what your take is on it. I did, however,
dedication. So it's a chunk of time to
right. And I did, however, pass on the words, the comments of one of our listeners who posted on Facebook who did talk about it and in a positive way. And pointed out that this is meant something positive to him or her. So maybe they should think twice before just assuming the worst.
Right.
Right. Absolutely. Rest in peace to Powers Booth and Chris Cornell. Any further things anybody wanted to bring up before we begin our episode? Anyone?
Oh, I do.
Okay, Mike.
I think Mike.
I do. There's some really awesome TV news. Well, first of all, the first one is that actually both, I think, are Netflix. Netflix is talking about, for those who are fans of Jim Henson and all things Muppet related, Netflix is going to be making a Dark Crystal TV series.
What?
They're doing a prequel series to the old cult classic Jim Henson film Dark Crystal.
Weird.
Which
they
have been trying to do something. They had at some point, I can't remember the guy's name, Tartakovsky, who did Dexter's Lab on Cartoon Network, was involved for a while trying to get a reboot of that film launched, and that never really went anywhere. I have no idea if this is going to be related to it at all. Second thing is that they are, I think it's Netflix who's doing it, Netflix is doing a Judge Dredd series, and they are talking to Carl Urban about resuming the role of Judge Dredd.
No shit.
That's cool. That'd be pretty cool.
And the third thing in the category of what could be gloriously cheesy or just plain cheesy, as we all know, Supernatural will simply not die. It is coming back for a 13th season. And in the 13th season, there will be an animated episode that will feature one crime-solving canine by the name of Scooby-Doo.
Ruh-roh.
Very good.
That was really good, Eric. I kind of thought I could swear the real Scooby was here.
All right, that's some good news. Also, Twin Peaks, the series, comes out this week on, I think, Showtime. And so, a lot of good stuff on TV, never mind on VOD and theaters.
And Get Out gets released, I think, on Blu-ray and disc, right? May 23rd?
I may have pre-ordered that.
Yeah, yep. I think Get Out. And there's an alternate ending floating around, but I haven't gotten a chance to see that. Have you guys seen that yet?
Not yet. I'm waiting for my disc to show up.
Is that the white people win ending? Is that the?
I don't know.
Yes,
I wanted to watch it, and I just didn't get a chance.
It's the white people ending. Yes, and it's everybody can see it now on Facebook, on Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, where one of our listeners, Chris Genro, posted it actually. So.
Okay, that was just a shot in the dark. I haven't seen it yet. I was waiting for the disc, but okay.
It's the ending that we thought was probably going to happen when the cop car pulled up.
Okay.
Gotcha.
So,
yeah. Anything else, Chrissy, or anybody? Anyone?
No. Think that's all right. Oh, somebody posted Shin Godzilla is getting released.
Oh, that was me. Yeah, that's getting a release. I think it's in August, finally, for the people who missed it in theaters. Shame on you.
I'm so excited.
It's going to be coming on to home video. I think they said August. They have not yet announced the special features, but it will be available in original Japanese and also in a new dub version. I don't know what the dub version.
No, that's good. Dub is good because it brings back the good old days when we used to watch the Creature Double Features.
Oh, that's true. When they would say things and their mouths would just not move at the same time.
Exactly.
It'll be the same disc. You'll have both options. And the nice thing is, I mean, I like the original track, but there are people who will not listen to it unless it's got a bad overdub. So
yeah,
it'll get more people to it. It'll sell better with it. Than without
it. And to be honest, Mike, a lot of people did not see it at the theaters for two reasons. Some people heard it wasn't that good, so they didn't go to see. But the main reason was for the fact that it was limited release in the USA. So you had to be near one of maybe, 500 theaters, and the other 2,500 got screwed and didn't get to see it.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to catch that in the theater.
Very good. Anything else, anyone? Or can we begin the movie? Anyone? All right,
let's proceed.
All right, sounds good. So with all that stated, Eric, why don't you let us know what we're discussing tonight?
Tonight, we're going to be talking about the 2001 Richard Kelly movie, Donnie Darko.
It was as though this plan had been with him all his life, pondered through the seasons. Now, in his 15th year, crystallized with the pain of puberty.
So, why'd you move here?
My mom had to get a restraining order against my stepdad. He has emotional problems.
Oh, I have those too. What kind of emotional problems does your dad have?
I met a new friend.
Real or imaginary?
You're a cop, Tony.
Imaginary.
I'm going to tell you a little story today about a young man whose life was completely destroyed by these instruments of fear.
I haven't seen stuff.
Donnie is experiencing what is commonly called a daylight hallucination.
I have to obey him. He saved my life.
Have you ever seen a portal?
Has he ever told you about his friend Frank, the giant bunny rabbit?
The what?
Every living thing follows a long set path, and if you could see your path or channel, then you could see into the future, right?
I'm not going to be able to continue
this conversation.
Don't worry. You got away with it.
What is going to happen?
I only have a few days left before they catch me.
We're just gonna stop.
You should already know that.
That's right. Eric mentioned director Richard Kelly. This is his first film. He's done a couple of films since then, Southland Tales and The Box. Both were...
Not as good.
Yeah, not as good and not successful at the theaters. He's an interesting cat in the sense that you would think he would have his fingers dabbling in other things, and really, really not much. So very curious about that. It was written by him as well. It stars a lot of up-and-comers at the time, and a few good actors that became leading actors on TV or theaters after this. But the folks were Jake Gyllenhaal. This was one of his defining performances that made him a star. Jenna Malone, also known from films like The Hunger Games and Neon Demon and The Ruins. This was one of her first roles. I think she was 18 at the time. Drew Barrymore, Maggie Gyllenhaal, one of her first roles. Mary McDonald, Catherine Ross, Patrick Swayze, Noah Wiley, and then...
It's also, believe it or not, he has a very small part, but it's Seth Rogen's first film.
Yep.
It is. Yep. That's true. Holmes Osborne is Donnie Darko's father, and he's been in every film that Richard Kelly has directed. And then Deve Chase plays his younger sister in the film. And she's gone on to become a big or a semi-big TV star and model. And in this film, she's only maybe like 8 or 10 years old. Yeah, interesting cast, no doubt. The film it says here the budget $4.5 million, box office $7.3 million. That's pretty much it of note that I have. It does have a pretty cool soundtrack with some hit songs and so forth. But the one thing I noticed after watching it, Eric, because I had forgotten, is that this film takes place in the very end of our high school years.
Right, yes.
And as a result, it's...
Awesome.
It was a pretty important film for our generation, specifically the four of us here, Abe Spinney not included, because he's 20 years younger than us. But
it's set in 88 in October of 88, but it was released in October 2001.
Right. But, right. My point is it takes place. I think I said it takes place.
Right. Well, I'm just making it clear when you said it's important to our generation. Our generation had already been kind of grown up by the time this was released, but.
Yeah, but
we remember being in high school in 1988.
Right.
That's the important part.
Right, right. I'm with Eric on this one, Mike. You ruined everything. You're
popping everything. You're being melodramatic.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm just clarifying it's, not Raiders of the Lost Ark.
You are correct. This is not Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, doesn't mean it's worse or better. It just means that it's not
I'm going to go out on a limb and say this is not as good as Raiders of the Lost Ark, but... Anyway,
yeah. I'll agree with that. Even though I could see some folks saying otherwise, but that's no here nor there. Anybody else wanted to bring up anything about the film before we discuss how we heard about it and our experience with it and whether we liked it?
I just real quick.
the reason Abe isn't here is he couldn't readily acquire a copy of this movie. It's currently not available on any digital service that I know. Well, you can buy it digitally, you can't rent it or stream it right now. Our conspiracy theory is that it has to do with the gorgeous four-disc collector's edition that Arrow just released, which I have purchased and highly, highly recommend for anybody who likes this movie. Because they did a really great job, not only with the rest with the scanning and the special features on the disc, but the packaging, everything you get along with it is awesome too. They give you even a little hardback book with a bunch of written material about the movie, so that is sweet. However,
I'm gonna have to just suck it up and buy it because I'm very excited now.
that being said, it's a little difficult to watch this movie in ways that most of us have been accustomed to at this point. But we would still encourage you to, well, at least I personally would encourage you to seek it out. And if you like, if you've seen and like the movie already, spend the, I think it's worth the $30 for the four disc collector's edition.
Yeah. By Arrow. And it's, just came out within the past month or so. So yeah, I would agree with that. Anything else, Sarge? Want to go? All right, let's do. I guess we can do the round table, how we heard about it and all this. I think two of us have never seen the film until this week.
It blew my mind. Honestly.
It's amazing. Yeah, yeah. This is kind of bizarre. Eric, why don't you start? Since this actually was your call, you wanted to do this film, and
yeah, I got excited after getting my collector's edition. And I've been trying to remember how I first heard about this movie, and I can't. I honestly can't remember if I saw this one that was in the theater or heard about it through some internet buzz afterwards and rented it or what the deal was. But anyway, I saw it pretty close to its release, whatever the case may be. And watched the movie, and for most of the movie had little to no idea what was going on. And then at the end was given enough to say, okay, I get it. Enough to understand what the whole thing was about. But then after that, some additional material was released by the director on the internet. There's a book in the movie on time travel that in the theatrical cut of this movie, you get only the briefest of glimpses at. And he actually wrote some of the book and put it up online for people to look at, kind of flesh out what he'd put forth in the movie. And it helped a lot. So when it came time to do the director's cut, he actually took some of that material and incorporated it into his director's cut to help kind of tie the whole thing together a little bit better.
Eric, that's the one we're going to discuss tonight, the director's cut.
Right. We are discussing the director's cut tonight. So the director's cut, the theatrical cut is still a good movie in and of itself. However, I would say that the director's cut is probably a little easier to stay with on a first watch because of the additional material that he put in. And whatever the case would be, I've been fascinated with this movie ever since I first watched it. I've probably watched it, including viewings with different commentaries, probably about half a dozen times now. I'm still not going to claim to understand the whole thing, but I love it.
Yeah, all right, sounds good. Any further things you wanted to bring up before we go to the next person?
No, let's head on to the next person.
All right, I'll go next since I've already seen the film way back years ago as well. I forget how I heard about it too, Eric, but I do know that I finally bought the director's cut, or the two-disc set that Christy has. Way back, and I double dipped just recently to get the Blu-ray box set as well, just like you, Eric. When I first watched it, I was amazed. I loved the film. It spoke in many ways to, as I stated, Eric, our generation, because it is our generation, right when we were.
It's very nostalgic if you were in high school in the late 80s.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it felt exactly how we were in high school, because back then we didn't have tablets and cell phones and all that stuff. And so everything that we see, we can relate to, never mind the ennui and anxiety that the students have in this movie. So I watched it like 20 times back in the day. So in the 90s, 96 or whenever. And so this is the first time I've rewatched it in of like 20 years. I told Mike offline a couple of days ago that it didn't hit me as much. But then again, when I reflect after selling that to Mike, a lot of it's probably because, you know, it's not new to me anymore. And like, even if I watch The Thing by John Carpenter, it doesn't do much for me as much as it did, say, the first 100 times I watched it. That stated, it's still a great film, and I think it has a lot to say to people, similar to, say, how Taxi Driver or films like that have become iconic. I think this is the reason why this film is considered not only a cult film, but one of the best science fiction films ever by a lot of folks, including, I think, the American Film Institute. High thumbs up, or big thumbs up for me. Now let's go to the people that never seen the film until this week. And Mike, why don't we start with you?
I never saw the film until last night.
There you go.
When this film came out, this is, again, October 2001, and only got a very, very brief theatrical window release, because that was in the days immediately after 9/11, and it featured a chunk of an aircraft falling out of the sky, and right. they were afraid there would be panic in the streets if this film got any sort of heavy coverage, and that, you know, but. Yeah, that was back in the days when they said, well, we think Americans are going to have their fill of disaster films for a long, long time. Nope. Not even close. Nevertheless, it's kind of snuck out. And this was, at this point, I had been married for less than a year. I was still settling into my job. I was not tenured. There were just a lot of other things going on in my life, and this was something that snuck by. And the internet was a thing, but not exactly the thing it is now. Funnily enough, Phil, you know, you say that we didn't have like the tablets and stuff back then. They didn't have them in 2001 either. So, you know, it's that's weirdly enough. Even it's though it's a new millennium film, it's from an era that still was more in common with it when we graduated high school than where we are now. But it just escaped my notice, and by the time I became aware of it and people talking about Donnie Darko, it was a cult film. I never had any idea what it was about, and I thought, oh, at some point I'll end up catching on to it. But there's also a weird part of me that when people say, oh, you have to watch something, resist having to watch it. So
traitor.
Okay. I don't know who I was betraying, but, it just, so it just wasn't something that I went out of my way to catch either. So I was kind of glad that we had to do it for this so I could finally check that off my list. And because I never waste money in small ways when I can waste money in large ways, I got the new box set to make sure I had, you know, the new edition, the special edition, and the theatrical, which I haven't watched yet. I just watched the director's cut, and having watched it last night and read up on the film, I don't quite understand how anyone could have understood the film in the theatrical version.
Right. I'd agree with that assessment.
And at the same time, I did think at times it was a little over-explaining and a little over-long, so I could understand that a shorter version, because it's about a 20-minute difference, right?
Right.
That's about right, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know that that 2 hours necessarily, 2 hours and 15 minutes necessarily serves the film either. So I don't know. It's I watched it. I enjoyed it. I don't know if I would say it's one of the greatest science fiction films ever. I'm not sure if I would even really classify it as science fiction film. It is a weird film. Then
it's an awesome film, Mike. Oh.
It is a weird film, and I can understand, you know, why so many people liked it. It didn't have that impact on me. Partly because it's, you know, I'm not of the age, I'm sure, that it was when that most people were when they discovered it. I'm much, much further removed from that ennui-riddled high school experience. And to me, the whole thing felt, and I don't want to sound like I'm down on the film. I'm not. It was a neat thing. It's a neat little exercise in a weird puzzle box of a film. But man, is it convoluted. And it more is. more so than I think it needs to be. And, you know, he's come up with these weird ass rules for his universe. And I don't know why the rules are there. I don't know what they signify other than I made up weird ass rules to time travel. And okay.
Well, and to be honest, after listening to a couple of commentaries on it, I'm not entirely sure that Richard Kelly fully understands everything about it himself.
Huh, that's interesting.
Well, that sometimes happens too.
I mean, if you're probably right, Eric, but I think the point is if you just boil away the whole plot, I mean, the whole film, and just look at what he's trying to say, you could say it could be a couple of things like selflessness and I don't know. We'll discuss. I'm sure Christy will have some things to say. So anything else, Mike?
No, that's it. We'll talk more as we get into it.
All right. Chrissy.
I first heard of this movie in 2004. I had sold a short story to a magazine called Loving Bunny. That was the name of my story. And the editor wrote back to me. And it was about a guy whose wife, you know, is obsessed with this plastic Easter rabbit that she like wants to put on the lawn that she picks up at a junk sale. Mm-hmm. And she brings it into the house, and the guy starts to have this unnatural like obsession with this plastic bunny. So the guy called me, the editor emailed me actually back then. I wasn't on email all the time. Like still having email was like a big thing. And he said, oh, he goes, I really love this story. And it's, you know, but this is what I think we should call it. I think we should call it How I Learned to Stop Complaining and Love the Bunny, because the themes in here kind of remind me of Dr. Strangelove and some stuff going on in Donnie Darko. And I went, oh, okay, that sounds great. Why don't you change style then? And they were paying me a lot of money at the time. I think I got paid $400 for that story, which is still the most money I've ever made on a short story. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to be like an idiot and be like, oh my God, okay, what's Donnie Darko? Like, what is that about? You know, I kind of didn't really understand what he was saying about my story in relation to Dr. Strangelove, but whatever the hell, I don't care, whatever. He was paying me, so whatever. You can still find that story now. I actually resold it to a place where you can still get it now, even though the magazine is – it was a print magazine, so it's long gone now. And then I just kind of put it mentally on my list and then over to watch at some point. And then over the years, I would just hear – you know, somebody would mention it every once in a while, and I'd be like, oh, yeah, I got to see that. Oh, yeah, I got to see that. But other than knowing that there was a rabbit of some sort in it, I did not know anything about it. So it was delightful to sit and just enjoy this in one sitting and really focus on it. I have to say that I was very curious about what the theatrical version must have been like, because the director's cut seemed to me like it was pretty complete, but I was coming at it from a different perspective. I really felt that this movie is like a really awesome, dark short story. It's the way that all good short stories should be written. It's art, but it's not pretentious. It uses every literary device out there exceptionally effectively, but it also uses it subtly. It has a message that speaks to the human condition in a moving and a very personal, but also a very universal way. I think we can all sort of relate to, if not Donnie himself, one of these other characters. I'm really sorry that this movie didn't see it before now. But then on the other hand, I was kind of like, oh, I'm sort of glad I didn't see it before now, because I don't think I would have appreciated it in the way, like if I had seen this when it first came out, I think all of the levels and stuff would have been lost on me because I really didn't have any kind of training yet. And I plan to watch this a lot of times and pull it apart. And I really think that this, you could probably write really interesting theses about this movie. Maybe not either in, maybe not in a film class, because I don't know that much about the technical aspects of film, but from a story standpoint, you certainly could, like in a literary class, you could. But you know, I also saw this and I realized how much shit has really come out. I remember I was sitting there thinking, oh my God, why am I watching all this other shit when I could be watching stuff like this? Why isn't there more of this? It was really kind of sobering for me. Made me realize how much time I waste watching crap, to be honest with you. Like, I got to clean up my act here and start watching some more stuff on my own that's really high quality. I was really, really impressed with this. And I went into it expecting this is going to be some bizarre movie that I'm probably not going to understand, and I'm just – but I've got to watch it. So I'm really, really happy that I did. So thank you guys for – making me get off my ass. It is now off my list of shame.
Very good, very good. Yeah, actually, too bad this podcast wasn't around in 1996, or 2006, because back then I had all the stories and what it meant and all that, and now 21 years later, I forget all that. So,
Phil, you didn't write it down anywhere that you couldn't have dug up your old notes? No, really, that would have been cool. Because I think
it's
as you 11 get
years
older,
film,
too, your perspective changes. Like, I think if I'd watched this when I was, like, in my 30s or whenever the – however the hell old I was in 2001, I don't – like I said, not only because of the lack of training, but I'm younger. I have a different perspective. I think it would be fascinating to watch – to, like, not watch this for 20 years and then rewatch it 20 years from now and see how your perspective has changed on it.
True.
It is really kind of one of those films that I think really does change. Your opinion is going to change over time, and you're going to see different things over time. I don't know.
I think you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah. Also, I would like to state that thank you, Mike, for embarrassing me for saying the bad math or doing bad math.
Sorry.
That's all right. That's all right.
Look, I was dealing with chemistry students today who couldn't do 16 minus 8 without a calculator. I wanted to cry.
Seriously?
Seriously.
Now I want to cry.
What are you going to do? Yeah, that is pretty bad. All right, so I guess with all that, I guess we can do the wiki.
Wiki. All right, the IMDb description of this movie is: a troubled teenager is plagued by visions of a man in a large rabbit suit who manipulates him to commit a series of crimes after he narrowly escapes a bizarre accident.
The film takes place in Virginia. Was filmed in greater LA, but for whatever reason.
I was going to say that did not look like Virginia to me at all. I could clearly tell that was California.
Yeah, it didn't look remotely Virginia-y to me. It was. I thought it was very obviously set in California. I don't know why.
Yeah, that's what I thought it was too. I'm very surprised, Phil.
Well, yeah. They put Virginia license plates on the car. That's the only way we'd know.
Yeah, I guess so. Okay.
Yeah.
So can I assume that we all just, you know, identify with the Patrick Swayze character? That would be.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, my God. I loved that character. What a sleaze. Feel it coming off him. The oil is just coming out of the screen.
Hang on, Christy. Phil's got an agenda.
Yeah, we can't. Let's hold all that good stuff for the spoiler alert section. Anything else we want to say before we do throw up that spoiler alert?
I normally tell people to go watch the movie and come back and listen to it. And if you really don't want to be spoiled, that's what you should do right now. But at the same time, this movie is just so strange, and I don't fully understand it, even having watched it multiple times. I doubt that whatever we're going to say during this podcast would ruin anybody's enjoyment of the movie, because you can try and describe it, but you're not going to get it until you just watch the damn movie. So this is your spoiler alert, if you care. But I don't think getting spoiled on this particular movie is going to have a negative effect on your overall viewing experience.
Yep, and the film does take place in a 31-day period of October of 1988, So it's a period piece, even when it was made, as Mike mentioned, 2001, and so forth. Yeah, I guess that's about it. I was going to say one other thing, but that would be a little bit of a spoiler. But it could have to do with time travel.
That's a spoiler warning, Phil.
Yeah, all right. So let's spoilers one's up. So we can discuss anything and everything. Let's talk about the film. I have a question for anybody's opinion of the Donnie Darko character and his ennui. Is his issues, people's opinion here, is his issues specifically related to just being a 17, 18-year-old kid that's just pissed that he sees the somewhat fakeness of adulthood, similar to, say, a book like Catcher in the Rye or the Quentin Compson character in The Sound and the Fury? Or is there something more going on about this character?
I personally think there's a little something going on more. Most of it is typical teenager stuff, but he also does mention at one point that he burned a house down earlier in his life. When he first meets the Gretchen character, the Gretchen character discloses that her stepfather stabbed her mother in the chest before she gives that piece of information, she says that her stepfather has emotional problems, and Donnie's response is,
line ever.
Oh, I have those too. Yes. What kind does he have?
Well, I don't know. I personally think the best line ever is, I doubt your commitment to Sparkle Motion. But
yes, that's a pretty good line. Awesome.
This movie is ultimately quotable.
Even better, Mike, was the one about, he said he forcibly would shove something up my anus. Yeah. Or something like that. That was a good line, too. But anyway, I'm sorry. Continue, Eric.
I believe that Donnie, even before all of this, was emotionally troubled. Although I don't think that has any particular relevance to what happens in the movie.
Well, I do. It's interesting because at the beginning of the film, one of the first thing that happens is there's kind of an argument at the dinner table about the sister says that, oh, Donnie's not taking his medication. And so that was a signal right there that he was supposedly on medication for something. And
what
then later on,
bitch, what a
yep,
bitch.
And, Bill. Oh, fuck ass. And they're doing that whole thing about
fuck ass.
Yeah, I was going
to say, Phil, the term you're looking for is fuck ass.
To sell someone out to their parents is not cool.
So it was interesting because he has the argument with his mother, you know, and he's like, oh, why don't you start taking the goddamn pills? And then I kind of guessed at that point that it might have been schizophrenia. Only because, you know, it's clear that he hears another voice in his head. And I thought it was interesting because in the setup of this, they sort of go down the Edgar Allan Poe road where you're like, okay, so is this person, you know, have an issue? Is he a schizophrenic? Or is this going to become a kind of film where we're wondering if the supernatural is sort of really going on and it's preying on an emotionally weak person? I think they did that setup really well, and I loved that they kept me guessing. Like, even till the end of the film, I could not decide which one it was until the very end, for myself anyway. But then, later on, jumping ahead, the Catherine Ross character does mention paranoid schizophrenics and paranoid schizophrenia and says that the auditory hallucinations are part of it. And it's common, and how that's when she says to the mother, I want to up his pills and I want to do hypnosis.
Well, and
so, I mean, yes, there's, to answer your question, the kid has problems, definitely of some sort. So,
okay. We'll return to my other point later, Mike.
Well, yeah, I think it's I think she's a pretty incompetent doctor, but for I think for what Eric is referring to, but
no, yeah. Go ahead, Eric. What was it? Because we're all trying to answer
it. It was very strange that she recommended upping his medication when she was giving him water pills.
Yeah, well, I thought that was interesting too, and that was also kind of why I'm like, there were so many moments here where I was in this movie where I was like.
Could that just been an error by the screenwriter?
No, I don't think so. I think that was done intentionally. I think it was because of where this movie ends up going in the end. That stuff, like with the placebos and stuff, doesn't make sense until you understand the ending. Then you can kind of go back and go, oh my God, okay, yep, I get that, I get that, I get that. But I think it, I really think that they just were, that the screenwriter or the director or whoever was really keeping us on our toes about trying to figure out who it was. At least for me, I was like, oh my God, okay, is this kid schizophrenic or is this really going on? Well, like the whole time I was trying to figure that out.
Well, and the other thing is before everything happens, he burned down a house.
Right.
So I think it's, I could be wrong. I'm not a psychiatrist, but I think it's a really bad idea to give placebos to someone who is violently psychotic.
But is he psychotic? He could be a cult hero. He symbolizes all of us. What's that, Mike?
I'm sure you'll agree with his whatever he's doing, but you know, he burned down a house. He is dangerous. He is a danger.
You are both right. He is a danger, but I can confirm that according to one of the commentaries I listened to, the director/writer does intend for him to be a superhero type of character. Which is why one of the reasons he gave him the alliterative name of Donnie Darko.
He's like an anti-hero, Mike. Like Travis Bickle.
But it doesn't mean that he's not psychotic. And the job of someone's psychiatrist is not to turn them into a superhero.
Right.
One of their jobs would be for, at the very least, if you're treating a child, you know, a 17-year-old, I'm guessing, with psychotic tendencies, is to not have them burn shit down.
Well, he hasn't burned shit down.
You're so picky, Mike.
He hasn't burned shit down for years. It was a few years prior.
Right, but the other thing that's interesting, like we were talking about, she's not much of a doctor if she's giving this psychotic kid placebos. I kind of was starting to notice that the parents were really in denial about whatever was wrong with their son. So after the movie was over, I thought about it and I was like, you know what? The mother is in denial the whole time. The father is in denial the whole time because they keep saying, oh no, he's not crazy. Oh no, whatever. And then when the doctor says, I want to up his medication, you know, the mother is crying. So I think they deliberately took him to this quack doctor believing that maybe he isn't really all that sick.
What about this, Chrissy?
That was kind of what I got out of it.
What about this, Chrissy? They knew he's sick, but since this movie, you could argue, is a fable more than just a straight, drama, science fiction thriller, maybe to them, this kid represents anti-hero against the establishment.
Yeah, I mean, that could be the case. I think this is also one of those movies where, honestly, it's one of those movies that we can talk about where nobody's really wrong. There's so much going on in here that everybody is going to walk away from this with something different. And I think that's the brilliance of this movie, and I think that's why it became kind of a cult thing. Because there's no wrong answer. Like, there really isn't. There is so much shit going on in this movie that you could grab onto anything and pretty much be right. It's like writing a thesis. That's why I said this is great thesis material. You can pick anything out of this movie and write a literary thesis about it, and you can't be wrong. You can't. There's too much crap.
One of the commentaries on the director's version is actually a commentary with Richard Kelly and Kevin Smith. And Kevin Smith is kind of peppering him with questions to explain stuff in the movie. And alternately, giving him a whole bunch of shit for taking it way too far. Because we'll ask him about something, and Richard Kelly would say something the car in a video game is a red car, which kind of is the same as Frank's car, so they kind of tie together, and maybe it's a foretelling of what's going to happen later. And Kevin Smith just goes, "Ah, dude, what the fuck? Seriously? Why can't it just be a car? Why can't it just be a car?"
And that's why Kevin Smith's films suck, because he doesn't think deeply enough. So let's go there.
but some people, not a fan of Kevin Smith necessarily, but some people would say that it just being a car shows that he's not a pretentious douchebag. which some people say is the problem with Richard Kelly's next two films.
Well, and sometimes, you know, admittedly, sometimes he could have just picked a red car and not really thought about it. You know, sometimes when you create stuff, you're not thinking, and I think Philip and anybody else who's listening to this right now who does create things, whether it's film or writing or painting or whatever, you know, sometimes your brain just does this stuff and you don't think about it. You don't realize you did it. And so then you're in an interview and somebody points it out to you, and your smart answer, like my father taught me, was always like, you always say that you intended to do it. Sure, I did that on purpose. Absolutely.
Like George Romero, Mike. George Romero.
Well, brilliant. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Now, let me, this is where I puncture in it, which is I'd say people are really good at finding patterns, right? I mean, it's the reason why you can get a movie like Cars, because we look at the front of a car, we see the headlights, we see the bumper, we see a face. There's not a face there, but we see a face there.
Christine, or anything like that.
Well, basically, Mike's meaning is that you know, the two headlights are eyes, and then the grill is the mouth, and whatever.
Yeah, totally. I know what you mean. Go ahead, Mike.
But continue, Mike. Yeah,
a smiley face in no way looks like a person's face, but we read patterns. We are. It is a thing that helps us to survive, because any patterns that we could see, like if you eat the red berries with the black dots, you're going to die. We learn not to do those things, or we learn to do things, and it's a survival thing. So, but sometimes we see shit that ain't there, like we see patterns in clouds or what have you. And so when we look hard enough, we can find shit that isn't there. And then we can convince ourselves, I must have put that there subconsciously because I'm an artist. Or, you know, we can read stuff. And so, right, the best thing to do is just say, yeah, sure, I meant that. I'm brilliant. And take it. But you can find all sorts of things that really were not intended. And if you want to, you could read your own meaning into it. And there's all sorts of examples of that in human nature. You know, and just it's you know basically how optical illusions work.
And especially and in Dan Darko.
Right. And it is. And I'm not saying, yeah, there's a level of pretentious douchebaggery that can go with that, but it's something that we can all do. And in the end, we all are constructing our own meaning of our lives anyway. Why the hell can't we construct our own meaning of the art that we watch? Right?
Which I think is one of the themes in this. One of the themes in this is, how do you find your own meaning for what's going on around you? How do you interpret things? How do you interpret what's going on in your life? I think that's one theme, is the theme of interpretation, theme of perception as well. Not so much really perception. I think it's more interpretation, interpreting meaning or deriving meaning. I can't come up with a good developed thematic statement about it, but I kind of know what I mean. It's just how we interpret life. When everybody else is telling us we need to see things this way.
Right. He's
trying to interpret it, and he's clearly seeing things differently.
Well, but that's the thing, right? You could argue, and Mike gets pissed when I go overboard about stuff like this, but you could argue that Donnie Darko is the sane one because he sees things more clearly than everybody else.
Therefore,
he's the one that's right, and he's the non-insane person.
No, he's insane, but that doesn't mean he does not have insight.
Well, yes. Because there is that one moment there, which I really loved, when Patrick Swayze is like, oh, no, you need to have love, like the kid who wants to help her sister from eating too much, and then the kid who wants to fight, and the other kid who doesn't know what he wants to be when he wants to grow up. And this actually supports what we were just talking about. That's why I'm bringing it up now, about this idea of his insight. He is insane. But he gets up and he stands at that microphone, and everything he says makes absolute freaking sense.
It's all true.
It makes absolute sense. Tell her to get up off her ass, stop eating the Twinkies, and go to the gym. You know? And who the hell else knows what they want to be when they grow up? Nobody freaking knows. And you, somebody picking on you, go take karate lessons. And when they do something to you, kick them in the fucking balls. But he's telling the truth, even though he's insane. And that's why I think it's interesting. Because another theme in this movie is irony. Here you have sane, practical information coming out of the mouth of a supposedly insane person. You know, you have, I mean, there's irony all over this movie. That's one of the big themes. And it's kind of obviously
it's got irony on it.
Well, it's because he's not playing the game. He's a rebel. He's a rebel without a cause. That's why he's
but he could have also gotten up at that microphone and spewed shit that made absolutely no sense to anybody.
That's true.
He was giving practical, sound, like,
because he's not
mature advice. Yes.
Well, wait a minute. He also spends a good portion of the movie talking about time loops and time travel. And,
yes,
but he's right.
Exactly.
And energy worms coming out of people's chests. So he does spew a lot of shit that makes no sense whatsoever.
But he's right, because we see the energy worms and all this stuff.
Oh, but do we see it, or is it because we're seeing things through his eyes?
Yeah, see, that's what's interesting, too. And I got to say, I think that this was part of that, like I said, irony is so prevalent in this film, and irony in what it really means, and also, too, how we all really are two different people. We are the person on the outside, and we are the person on the inside. And you could argue that the rabbit, which I think I figured out what it actually is at the end, but you could argue that the rabbit was really his deep, dark, ugly side of himself.
Or it was his the hero side of him.
Right, that's what I'm saying. There's so many different things you can see in this. Like, nobody's wrong. You could just write about this movie forever. There's so much stuff in it. So anyway, he gets this message. Right? Should we just kind of do a loose plot?
Yeah, go ahead.
So they have a fight. The mother, you know, the family, they go to bed. He kind of goes to bed. And then in the middle of the night, he's awakened. And he kind of follows this voice out of the house. And he sees the rabbit. And the rabbit says, 28 days, 6 hours, 42 minutes, 12 seconds. That's when the world will end.
And the rabbit has the best voice ever.
Yeah, the rabbit has the best voice because it's not really what you'd expect. You'd expect something evil and like, bleh, you know. But you know what I love? I love when Donnie Darko says, why? Did you guys catch
that?
Freaking chilling, where he just goes, why? And it sounds like really totally possessed. It almost sounds
and he has that Stanley Kubrick, you know, the Jack Nicholson look. Like, he's, you can see that he's insane.
I don't know that if he's considered a particularly attractive person or not, but he can really make his face look creepy good.
Mm-hmm. In fact, worked for him in Nightcrawler too.
Yep.
Yeah. And also he kind of, there's a focus moment there on the chandelier, which is important before he goes outside. So then the next thing we see is the sister comes home. The father is sleeping in the chair in front of the white fuzz on the TV, because the TV's gone off for the night, and it has played its Star Spangled Banner and shut off, like
it
used to do in the old days.
Yeah, exactly. The good old days.
Yeah, the good old days. And then, you know what was interesting? Did you guys notice that when the rabbit tells him the time of, like, 28 days, 6 hours, 42, or whatever, that's when the world's going to end? When the rabbit tells him the time, the sprinklers outside sound like a ticking clock.
Interesting. Good.
Well, yeah, we all
do go back.
We all absolutely noticed that, Christy. That's we all did.
Well, I'm sorry, I noticed it, and I thought it was really neat. I'm like, that is really neat. Like, I actually went back and listened to it a couple times because I'm like, I want to make sure that's actually what I was hearing. And yeah, they totally made it sound like a ticking clock. I was like, that is really good. Somebody was paying attention.
Right now, that's something like with the Outrun, the video game. It's just footage of a video game. Put it in there, maybe for nostalgia purposes, maybe for, you know, he wanted the red car to represent something, or maybe he was doing it retroactively. But yeah, putting in the sprinkler sound, you have to do that in a film, right? You had to go in and put that sound in. He had to have a reason for doing it.
Right. Yeah. It wasn't just he wanted something in the background. Yeah. I mean, that's way too.
But why would you want it hitting at that particular time?
Exactly.
Right. Well, yes. And that's because the rabbit is giving him the countdown. And Eric, if any of you guys watch this movie again, seriously listen to it. I'm sure I'm not crazy, because I listened to it 3 times over and I'm like, that is freaking brilliant. Whoever did that is brilliant.
I'm sure you're correct about the sign. I don't think that precludes you from being crazy.
Okay, I'll take that. I never said I wasn't crazier.
But
how do you know I'm not crazy?
She didn't. But Mike had a good point, though, which was the folks who put the film together in post-production decided to put that sound effect in, and they chose to put it in at that specific moment. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just because, let's just put a sound effect in. You know, it was on purpose, most likely. So I'm with Christy on this, even if we all missed it. That doesn't mean that whether it was intentional or not, it doesn't mean that we're going to catch it. Like all of us have not caught it except for Christy. So.
No, and I don't know why I caught it. It might have been because I was watching it at work. And I was listening to it, and the phone rang, and I had to get the phone, so I was kind of listening to it while I was on the phone, and I was like, something is odd there. I need to go back and watch it again. I think that's why I caught it. It's just because of the way that I was watching it, that I had to get interrupted and go back and watch it, and then I went back and watched it a couple times to confirm. But anyway, after that, so he's out of the house. We see the sister come home. There is a giant crash in the house. The chandelier goes crazy. Huh?
Did it make you jump?
Oh, I totally was not expecting it at all. And then the next thing we see is he wakes up on a golf course.
Right. And we're introduced to the Patrick Swayze character.
Yeah.
And this film always was interesting to me because Patrick Swayze always, rest in peace, always played good guys, and I always felt this was an excellent casting choice because he does have that charisma and good looks of a salesman and whatnot, and yet it's unexpected that he would be a bad guy,
right?
Because of all the roles that he usually takes. So I felt it was an excellent casting call because
And I got to give credit where it's due. Which is that Drew Barrymore was actually the executive producer of this movie. And she probably used a lot of her connections to get such a star-studded cast for this indie film.
Yeah, because there was a lot. The cast was amazing. Catherine Ross was great to see her.
And I'm sure many of these people were working for far less than they normally take to do a movie.
Right, and we were, I'm pretty sure, this is peak Barrymore, right? This is 5 years after her kind of comeback cameo in Scream.
Mm-hmm.
And this is around the time like she's doing the Charlie's Angels films.
Right. Well, and then this is when she became a multimillionaire with her production company because she produced all the Charlie's Angels films and all that other stuff.
Right.
And so, yeah, that makes sense, Mike.
Yeah, so anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there it's pretty amazing that this $4.5 million indie film had this cast.
Indeed. Because Swayze was still a big name at that back
yes,
in those days.
Absolutely.
And he was willing to take a supporting role, too, rather than a leading role.
Well, and not only that, he's playing a scumbag pedophile. And that's kind of a brave choice for somebody with his profile.
I'm sorry, he was framed. They laid that out clearly in the film.
That's true, Mike. That is true. That's great. What else? So he goes, basically he wakes up on the golf course, basically, I guess, what it appears to be sleepwalking or something. And then he heads home, and he sees all the commotion at his house, and they discover that a plane jet engine has fallen from the sky, but the thing that makes the whole thing odd, besides just bad luck, is the fact that they have no idea, the FAA has no idea where this jet engine came from because there was no plane crashes or malfunctions or anything like that the night of this accident. So the FAA forces the family to sign papers to not talk about this to anybody because, again, this is 2001, made right before terrorism, though we've already had some smaller terrorist attacks prior to that. So I assume that they're alluding to, this is some sort of conspiracy thing that's going on, and they're not sure what's going on. The FAA.
Well, I think it's also, and I did not pick up on this until later, once we got toward the very end, but there was a moment toward the middle of the film where I was like, wait a minute, you know, when he came back to his family after the thing had gone through his bedroom, the jet engine, it's not like, you know, it's weird. His family was sort of standing there, but nobody asked where he was.
There's a conversation when he has the fight with his mom. It's alluded to that this is something he does on a regular basis.
He asks him where do you go at night.
So I think his wandering out of the house at night is something that's happened before, which is why they're not particularly perplexed by it.
Okay.
Right.
That just kind of struck me, or maybe there was an odd reaction there. I'll go back and watch that scene again. There might have been an odd reaction that I missed, or.
Oh, and Eric, that was a good scene that you brought up too, because this happened prior to all that. His mother comes in and asks him questions, and being a typical teenager, he's basically pissed and says, "Leave me alone, I'm reading," whatever. And then when she finally leaves the room, he says something like, "You fucking
bitch.
Yeah, you bitch," or something. and they show her perspective where she just stops and waits and decides not to go in, and then they show his perspective. And you can tell that he's pissed that she didn't come back in because he wanted to basically fight again because he keeps on staring at the door waiting. And then finally, she goes to the husband and tells him, and the husband has a great line. He goes, "Well, you're not a bitch, but you're bitching."
Right.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a pretty cool line because it sets up that relationship.
Phil?
Yes?
How old is your oldest child now?
She's 3 and a half.
3 and a half. So you got about 10 years before you're probably gonna have to start working that line in on a regular basis.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I tried to make my wife be the bad guy, and I'm the good guy.
Wow.
You're gonna be the one. You're gonna be the one going, "I think we should get her a moped."
That's exactly. Exactly.
That's awesome, Mike. Right.
The 9/11 references in here were interesting. I just want to talk about it while we're talking about the plane. Just because I think it might have been, or the way that I took it was really kind of making a comment on the splitting up of the families and the loss of all of that in its wake, you know, the loss people felt in its wake. And
well,
I kind of didn't figure that out until that very last montage toward the end where all the characters are sort of thinking.
That may just be a coincidence.
I just found it interesting,
that's all.
This movie was released on October 26, 2001.
So it was
done, all the shooting was done well before 9/11.
That's what I'm talking about the collective conscious too, because I don't know, it's just weird. Like they do obviously make a big deal out of the Watership Down reference, which is sort of tied to that same thing as 9/11, where war is, you know, it's going to reach us anywhere, everywhere.
Best book ever.
You know? Well, it's not like, you know, 9/11 was the first disaster to ever happen, right? So it touches on, those are fairly universal themes, right? And people, that anytime you get a big event like that, that's kind of how responses happen.
And if 9/11 hadn't happened, then I probably wouldn't have made that association.
Right.
Even though, as Eric pointed out, it was already in the can and done or whatever before.
Right. Well, sort
happened.
Of like, yeah. You know, you can watch, I've said this for a while, if you watch John Carpenter's The Thing, you could view that because it's all these men in close quarters who are getting contaminated by blood. You could kind of see this as an AIDS metaphor, except for the fact that it came out a couple of years before AIDS was a widely known and well-known perceived thing, right? I mean,
the book was written in 1938 or whatever it was.
In 1958, yeah. So, but at the same time, you could still see that, not as an intentional metaphor on the part of the director, but it could certainly speak to those fears and concerns in a modern audience. And I know, I remember reading a review for Alien 3 that there was somebody who was suffering from AIDS and saw that as an AIDS metaphor, where most people didn't, but it was personal to them, and that doesn't make that person's reading of the film wrong. It's just their personal take, because again, we're all kind of constructing our own reality. In that, I'll even take that with, you know, the Patrick Swayze character. While he's a douchebag, and those things that he was selling, and that
the idiotic gym teacher was selling is the sort of stuff that sets my teeth on edge. You know, whatever gets you through the day, you know, how bad can it be if it's helping you lead a happy life?
Yeah, yeah.
So go have your kiddie porn sex dungeon. Go ahead.
Well, and I think what's interesting, too, what was really interesting about this is that at this point in the movie, this is where things really start to kind of change. I think it goes from a movie you can pretty easily follow. Once that engine hits, this is where things kind of start to change up. I don't know if you guys agree with me. But.
Well, and that's because that's the moment when I don't know how much we want to delve into this during this podcast or not, but when Frank gets Donnie out of bed and lures him outside, that's when the tangent universe is created, because he's supposed to get crushed by that engine.
For folks who don't know what we're talking about, Frank is the name of the rabbit. I don't know if people...
Sorry. I forgot that not everybody knows that. you're right in that is the moment when the tangent universe is formed, as explained by the time travel book that we get snippets of throughout the movie.
Now, Eric, explain this tangent universe thing, because people are saying, what the hell does that have to do with a kid that's insane that burns houses down?
Well, it's all very confusing and vague, but there is a character in this movie, Roberta Sparrow, who is an old lady at this point. The kids around town refer to her as Grandma Death. But back in the day, she wrote a book called The Philosophy of Time Travel. And throughout the director's cut of this movie, we're getting little passages of this book on the screen. And part of what it explains is that every once in a while there will be a rip in the space-time continuum, and an artifact will come through, in this case being the jet engine, and create a tangent universe. And if something isn't done to return that artifact to the prime universe, then a black hole will form and undo creation.
Right, which is not good or good, depending on your perspective.
Right.
Yeah, well, that's your basic Science 101 class right there.
There you go. Indeed.
I hope I did a decent job of summarizing that, because that's a whole bunch of confusing movie crammed into a couple of sentences.
Yeah, that worked pretty good, Eric. I understood that. I mean, obviously I've seen the film, but it made complete sense in my opinion.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's what the film is not really about. That's the plot. What it's really about is who Donnie Darko is and the ennui and all that other symbolism and is he
well, and also too, I kind of, the way that I interpreted the ending kind of made all of that science fiction stuff sort of, again, creating your own universe. Like Mike was just talking about creating whatever it was you were just talking about a few minutes ago, Mike, where you create what's your own, like
happiness.
Well, you create your own, whatever you think the world is. You know what I mean? Like the fact that he got this book and he interpreted everything that was happening to him according to this book was really the way that he was interpreting what was happening to him. But the way that I personally interpreted the end of the film, that is not what was actually happening to him. That was just the way he was interpreting it. The way that they had a lot of little coincidences in there where things would always come back, you know, or like, for example, oh, like the father says to the mother, which Donnie Darko doesn't hear. So that's adds a whole other level to it. But he says to the mother after the accident, after Donnie escapes, do you remember Frankie Fiedler in high school who died on the way to the prom? They always said he was doomed. I wonder if people say that about our Donnie, but our Donnie dodged the bullet. And then so I think it's very interesting that there is a character that's named Frank who's in a bunny suit, and, you know, he calls him Frank. But if what I think happens is what happened at the end, then it makes sense that he would use Frank as the association, if that makes any sense.
Well,
to be clear, Frank is the name of the actual boy in the movie that's wearing the rabbit suit.
And, right, but he says, like my father before me, so it's implied that you know, whatever.
He's also the boyfriend of his sister.
Right.
Oh, okay.
So it's a real person, and it's not just inferred by a character.
Right, right. And in my opinion, or possible one scenario to think about this film, is like, as we know, certain folks, whether they're scientists or painters or whatever, see the world differently, to the point where no one can comprehend like they do what they see. And so I'm thinking Donnie Darko actually saw all this, because since, as Mike mentioned, he's probably insane, the insanity opens different doors to him that the normal mind can't see. It's like similar to like being possessed, or are they just insane in the head? Here, it's the same thing. Is he just insane in the head, or does he have doors that are open to him that normal people can't see?
Well, so, it's also kind of like, it's like 12 Monkeys. Is it time travel or insanity? Well, maybe it's both.
Well, and that's the thing, Eric. He's insane, but the insanity also allows him to have a different type of intelligence than other people. You know? So, you know, we see this from everything from sociopaths all the way to Albert Einstein. You know, so just because of, you know, Dustin Hoffman and the Rain Man or whatever. And yet, that's what makes sense when you said maybe it's both, because maybe it is both. It probably is both. I think it is both.
Yes, I agree.
We look at us, and we all have different backgrounds and experiences, and, you know, Donnie Darko, being a little bit nutso, has his different backgrounds and things, so we can all look at the same exact thing and, again, see it in a very different light and focus on different things. I'll focus a little bit more on, you know, the science fiction-y stuff because of my background. Chris, you'll focus on the literary stuff. Phil, you'll focus on the political stuff and the origins of every actor's country.
Heritage.
And
Donnie Darko. I mean, Gyllenhaal, he's a Swedish-American.
There we go. And, you know, Eric, because you have, like, music background and a technology background, you'll see more things in that, and you'll see. But everyone has... But we're all looking at the same thing, but we're going to get different stuff out just because what we focus on and what matters to us. And, you know, there's always things like when you mentioned your buddy Dan, who can't watch a legal drama without focusing on what's wrong with how they do the legal stuff, right?
Right, right.
Where the majority of people would just, they don't care.
Right.
But we all have things that we are... if not experts in, more expert than the average person is,
mm-hmm.
right? And we can say, well, that's bullshit. That's never how that's going to happen, you know. But for the rest of the audience, it's not a big deal. But so we're all focusing on different things, and Donnie Darko sees things, again, from his perspective and his light, and he focuses on something some way too. But
yeah, I think this is a really interesting movie to discuss because of that, because we all do have something totally different to bring to the table, and there's so much to talk about. It's just one of those gold mines, you know, gold mine movies where there's so much to talk
about.
Well,
and I've watched this movie repeatedly, as I've said, and every time I watch it, I pick up on a little new thing that I didn't catch before. This time it was actually a funny line that I missed every time I watched a movie before. It's after... at one point, the school floods, and there are a bunch of kids outside talking about the flood, and there's a bunch of teenage girls talking to each other. One of them says, "Oh, I heard the boys' locker room got flooded with feces."
Oh, yeah.
And another girl says, "What's feces?" And another girl says, "They're baby mice." And they all go,
"I know."
I totally missed that every time I watched the movie up until last night.
Weirdly, I picked that one up right away because I focus on feces. And then there was silence.
Indeed.
As we're all thinking about baby mice and feces.
Or thinking about Mike and his obsession with feces.
Oh, that's so gross. Well, I thought there was some really interesting imagery in here. There's a real focus on circles. I don't know if you guys noticed that. That's why I'm looking forward to watching this movie again a few times, because I bet there's so much stuff in there I missed. But
there's a lot. There really
is. The pupil of the eye is focused on a lot. The center of the airplane engine. In the movie theater at the Fright Fest, there are lit things on the wall that are round and backlit. The thing.
Yeah, I noticed those too, Chrissy. Yeah, those.
Yeah, in the center of his chest.
They were like suns. They were like suns.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And I think the things, you know, that the time shift arms or whatever they're called, that kind of tether, they're round at the end. So there are a lot of round things in the movie they're watching. The clock, the portal. These are symbols of the idea. I think that life is kind of a cycle, and there's that whole theme of creation and destruction. Like, you must destroy to create, which is part of the Graham Greene story they were talking about called The Destructors. For those of you who are not familiar with it, it is a classic short story. It's called The Destructors. It is, I don't know if it's taught in high school English or literary classes too much anymore. But I know that back in the 70s and 80s it was. It was written in the mid-50s. And you can find it online for free if anybody would like to read it. I Googled it today so that I could give out a resource. Like,
yeah, the
sort of something.
Yeah,
you can
find it
Google
everywhere.
It. Just Google The Destructors by Graham Greene, and there is a PDF on it. There is also that's available for free for download. There is also a lot of analysis of that short story out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Cliff Notes and whatever, Spark Notes, or all that crap they have out now online. So if you want to read the short story and then read about the themes in it and how the themes in that short story, which I'm not going to spend half the podcast talking about now, all I'm going to say is that they definitely connect with a lot of the themes in Donnie Darko.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're interested in that and you want to read that, I think that scene where the English teacher is talking about it will mean a lot more to you. So,
and how'd you like the PTA meeting where
oh my God, that was fantastic.
Kitty,
I was laughing.
Kitty
my butt
Farmer.
Off. I have been at PTA meetings where women actually act like that. Like,
Kitty Farmer is the name of the character who's, I guess, the gym teacher at the school.
Yes.
And she's this hilariously neurotic woman. And first of all, she has a great line when she stands up at this PTA meeting and says, I, being a teacher at this school and a parent of a child at the school, I'm the only person that transcends the bridge of the parent-teacher association. It's just like, oh my God, woman, really?
No, but what's scary is that Mike, and I don't know if Mike's been to any PTA meetings, but I used to get dragged to them when I was younger. And because, you know, I had my brothers and sister in school, my mom had passed, and so I would end up at these PTA meetings all the time. And man, this woman was right on. I saw so many women like that, and they really are psychos.
And then there's
go home and have a drink and calm down.
There's another great line when she's trying to get this Graham Greene story banned because it involves flooding, and the school got flooded.
Yeah.
Clearly with bad influence on the children. And Donnie Darko's mother asks her, dude, do you even know who Graham Greene is? And she goes, well, yeah, I think we've all seen Bonanza. Oh, classic.
Well, and I loved the gym teacher, too, because there's that, you know,
oh,
when she's
priceless.
Showing... Is she showing the inspirational film about fear? And the film is so cheesy. We all saw those in the 80s, right, guys? We were all in high school in the 80s and early 90s. So you would see these cheesy videos with, like, the bad, like, Muzak in the background and stuff. And the look on her face when she is proudly showing this inspirational video as she's standing there in her white sneakers and her like, you know, those sweatpants that they had in the 80s that were like shiny. I was just like, oh my God, dude, that's like every gym teacher I had in the 80s.
Well, and just as a side note, it was kind of an interesting little piece of trivia, which is that Patrick Swayze actually still had his clothes from the 80s and used them in this movie as his wardrobe.
Oh my God, that's fun. Oh my God, that's fun. That is so totally great. Because I was like, wow, look at his 80s pants and his 80s sweater.
Those were his actual 80s pants, yes.
And his 80s hair.
There was a lot of good lines, good scenes and whatever. My favorite scene of the whole movie was when he's in the hallway, Donnie Darko's in the hallway, and the chubby girl's there. And,
Charita?
Yeah, Charita or whatever it is. Yeah, and he grabs her and he says something like, don't worry, it'll get better. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily that's true, because a lot of people, worst things happen, you land up on the street or whatever. But his point was, the hell that you're going through now in high school is only temporary. And that's mm-hmm. what he meant. And I thought that was an awesome line, because there's another moment of Donnie Darko wisdom that makes him a cult hero.
But and yet she rejects it, oddly enough, because she matters. He matters to her,
right?
Because we see that she's got a crush on him because she's doodling his name on her notebook.
Yeah.
And so she's got a crush on him. And so it's weird that because she has a crush on him, she can't hear what he has to say. Right. She rejects it.
Well, yeah, that's one way to interpret it. Another way to interpret it is she could think that he is being
making
mean to
fun of her.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. Well, but that's it. But it's ironic, right? It's that she's been tormented up to this point.
Yeah.
Even though we have seen him be nice to her and tell people to stop making fun of her.
I was about to say that too, Mike.
She can't trust him. And that's a sort of a reflection on how kind of damaged she is what I'm getting, is that so even though he is doing exactly what she would probably wish, which is he's being nice to her, he's offering her a word of kindness and hope, right? Because I think he probably recognizes that she's a good and decent person, and once she gets away from these dumbasses in high school, she has a better life waiting for her.
And her response is, shut up!
Yes.
Yeah, but Mike, maybe it's also because it came out of nowhere, because here's a guy that defended her here and there, but he never really had much conversation with her. And then out of the blue, he just goes up to her for no reason, it seems, even though in his mind there's a reason, because he's how his mind's working, he's thinking and whatever. And he goes up to her and he grabs her and he says that. So she freaked out. And even if she could trust him or did hope for something like that, it was a bit out of the ordinary for her. Never mind the fact that she's such a shy and troubled girl anyway, from being bullied for so long, that's just a normal response. And you could argue that that's her flaw, not the flaw of her thinking Johnny Darko is a bad guy because of how he presents himself.
Well, no, and also it was the way that he kind of came up to her and grabbed her too. It was a little bit like, whoa, you know.
It was forceful, a little bit. Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't like violent or intended to be mean or anything like that. But it was, I mean, my God, I would run away too.
Charita wears earmuffs. According to the director, it's because she takes so much verbal abuse that she just started wearing earmuffs so she doesn't hear it. But he grabs her by the earmuffs. I think his intention is just he wants to make sure that she can hear him. So he grabs her earmuffs and kind of lifts them up so her ears are uncovered so she can hear what he has to say. But then she runs away and leaves him standing there with her earmuffs. And then we actually see him walking home wearing earmuffs.
That is cool. One other thing about her that you guys may not noticed, but I noticed it every time I see the film. It's just so obvious. There's a scene when they're all waiting at the bus. Not the first time we meet her, but one of the second or third times. And there's a pole, a light pole, and she's on the right side of the light pole, separated from everybody else. And I don't know if anybody had ever noticed that.
I didn't specifically notice that.
I didn't either. That's cool, though. I'll have to look at that. I'll have to check it out.
She's clearly an outcast.
Yeah. So, but yeah, that was, I felt that was important, because he knows that society, life, high school, all these things are just a sham, and that it's going to get better for her because, you know, she'll get to create her own world when she gets older and whatever and so forth. So I felt that was it always stuck with me, that line anyway.
And there's also just while we're talking about Charita, since she doesn't get much screen time in this movie, there's a scene later during the talent show for the school where she's doing this dance dressed as an angel, and although it's set up so that people are going to be ridiculing her as usual, I thought there was really something kind of beautiful about that little routine that she did.
Yeah, it's an art house type of ballet type thing, and it's unfortunate for her because, again, that's just an extra target for people to attack her. But for normal people, not necessarily true, because some of the adults even rolled their eyes when she did it. But more appreciative people or tolerant people would look at it and say, "Good for you."
Mm-hmm. Right, and I'll point out, I had a student a couple of years ago, and I think she ended up as valedictorian, but she was not a svelte girl, and she did dance, and they, like, had a talent show, and she came out, and she did like, her interpretive dance number, whatever it was, and it was something along these lines, right, and it wasn't some pretentious douchebaggery stuff, it was just, you know, dancing a well-known dance number. But, you know, she has to get out there in leotards, and she doesn't have what most people would consider a conventionally attractive figure. Mm-hmm. Right now, someone who has spent his entire life dealing with a larger than average body size, mm-hmm. you know, I would be way too self-conscious to do something like that.
Right.
Right. But so, was she a popular girl as a, you know, charisma-wise?
I wouldn't say popular. Her brother was the popular one.
Okay.
But I also wouldn't say she was, though I could be wrong because you don't always see this, I don't think she was necessarily mocked the way the girl in this film was. But still, the fact that she can go out there, even though she obviously has issues, right? She can go out there and put herself out there in a way to be mocked and ridiculed, right? And in a way that I certainly never would have when I was that age.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. That's an excellent point, Mike. Because, yeah, like me, if I had to, I wanted to do something, I would probably have at that age chickened out and you know, 20 years later say, damn, why didn't I do it? Because I would be too scared, not just for being picked on, but just for the tension of everybody watching me too. So, and or just, you know, like the guy in Back to the Future, the father, where I don't want people to see my book because they may think it sucks, you know. So mm-hmm. So I see your point, but yeah, you're right. Here's this girl that's been tortured. And maybe she was at the cusp of knowing that life is going to be better anyway, even before Donnie Darko did it, because she had the courage to already start doing things that a lot of folks her age, or just any age, wouldn't do for the fact of being ridiculed or scared or whatever.
Well, and right, she's so, also, her dance is very angelic in a way, and I'm sure there's some symbolism in there that I haven't cracked yet. I'm sure it's got something to do with something. It just struck me, and I'm like, there's something about this, but I don't really have time to think about this right now, so maybe on a second watch I will, but...
Well, it's the kind of thing that makes me think, you know, if she can do that, that once she gets away from these assholes, that, yeah, she will be okay. Right? That once that baggage is cut free, and it will be, you know, there's still enough of her willing to put herself out there. She's not that damaged.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Well, that's a good point. Yeah.
I'm sorry. In the context of how I thought the movie ended, it almost speaks to me as like he's giving her a message, sort of from beyond, only because the way we see her laying and thinking at the end. So I don't know. That is completely my own personal interpretation. But afterward, I thought about it, and that's kind of what I came up with. But,
well, the interesting thing is when we get to the end, she's actually the one I was curious about, because we don't see her.
We do. Yeah, I think we do. We see her. Yeah, we do.
We just see her laying in her bed, but she has kind of a little smile on her face, which is sort of interesting. And I think that's what made me think about it. It's not like a giant smile. It's just, compared to everybody else who looks upset, she looks content. And mm-hmm. I thought that was kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. But like I said, I'm going to go watch that whole thing again. So,
well, see, that's the problem with this film, because there's just so much in it, and yet it's all what is symbolism and what's not, what happens and what's not. So like again, if this was, and I'll do my math correctly, Mike, this time, 11 years ago, I would have had all the answers, because I dissected this film like insanely, because this was like, you know, Taxi Driver to me back 11 years ago. So.
You saw Taxi Driver when you were 10 years old.
That's right. That's right. Excellent film. Greatest film ever.
Also, it depends on how you interpret the ending, whether or not you actually go back and see this stuff also. That's what I'm saying about it's whoever said that it was sort of convoluted, I totally agree with it, because we're having trouble kind of discussing it in a linear fashion, but I don't necessarily think it was convoluted in terms of, oh my God, I'm completely lost. Now, I have not seen the theatrical version, I don't know. Maybe that's a whole different story.
Well, and Rob made a comment at the beginning of the episode that he thought it was a little over-explaining, and I think that was an overreaction to people's comments after seeing the theatrical cut about how confusing it was.
But I think this is the problem. See, like Phil brought up Back to the Future. Back to the Future has no more scientific sense to it, right? It's time machine.
88 miles an hour. Why?
You hit 88 miles an hour. You can go wherever you want.
The flux capacitor.
And everybody who watches that movie gets it, which is and if there's a some sort of paradox, then you can change the future and wipe out your history, and you're not allowed to run into yourself because, you know, there'll be bad things.
Ronald Reagan, the actor?
So, but it's a simple idea, and the audience grabs it and moves on. Here you have, okay, not just the idea of a time loop, which I think we all could, or tangent universe. Mm-hmm. All right, if you have any basic background knowledge for science fiction, you could get the idea of a parallel dimension or a branching off of a timeline. We got that. And you know, nerd culture has been dominant enough long enough that 90% of your audience can probably hang there with it. But then you start getting these things like the manipulated dead and the manipulated living and the artifact and all this other stuff that's like, where is this all coming from and what is it meaning? And like, so you figure out that Frank, in fact, is – and what's the girl's friend's name again? Gretchen?
Gretchen, yeah.
That they're actually the people who die later in the film, and that they're the manipulated dead coming back to help – Donnie Darko meet his destiny to save the universe like Flash Gordon, right? But it's just like, where? I mean, how many rules do you have to come up with, you know, to justify the story element, right? It's, can't you just pull it back a little bit? And, I mean, look, I get it, that if this was a simpler story, it might not be as popular and it might not endure because that puzzle aspect of it,
right?
That very convoluted nature of it is what appeals to a lot of people, where for me, it's just sort of like, you know, I tend to focus more on the straightforward. Why did you make it so what feels to me needlessly complicated?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. I see where you're coming from, Mike.
I don't know if the director would necessarily disagree with Mike either. Because I was listening to the commentary tracks, some of this stuff I don't think ever fully formed itself in his head before he shot the movie, which is probably one of the reasons he tried to fill in a lot of the blank spots with that with the excerpts from the time travel book. But I still don't think that necessarily even the creator of this story necessarily has all the answers, so maybe he was trying to overcompensate.
Is the time travel book in the theatrical version?
It is, but you don't see nearly as much of it. Basically, you see you see the cover, and you see the one illustration that shows the thing in the middle of the chest.
Yeah, it's almost like that was the part that when he brought it to the producers or whoever bought the film from him, said, all right, you got to cut out stuff. Let's cut out. Where can you cut out? And that was the stuff that went.
Well, see, I thought because I have not seen the theatrical version, all of that extra stuff from the book didn't bother me, and I didn't feel like it was over-explainy, but that was because I was sort of going along for the ride of the film and going, oh my gosh, everything that's explained in this book, he seems to find after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting, almost like getting back to that idea that he's creating his own reality. Out of what he's reading, he's creating his own reality. When somebody says something to him, it coincidentally or magically fits into this mythos that he's created for himself. So that's why I think I didn't feel that was over-explaining, because I was interpreting it in a completely different way.
Mm-hmm.
I thought a comment was being made rather than it being explaining, if that makes any sense. I didn't think it. Anyway, go ahead. But I could see where Mike is coming from.
Well, it's over-explaining because it has to be explaining because it's convoluted, right? It's a weird system he's devised here to travel through time and to save the universe instead of just fire torpedoes down the exhaust port. So, you know, he's got to have magic powers. He's got to, you know, it's all this stuff is in there, and it's bizarre, and it makes sense from its own internal logic.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
Yeah, that's exactly I was thinking this kid was just making making all this stuff up, and that's why it really didn't make a whole lot of sense.
Well, and that's why
kids do that.
Well, that's why I was saying earlier that this film, even though it's the story is the time plot, but the meaning is something else. So when they decided to cut stuff for the theatrical, Kelly decided to cut the plot was, because the thing that was important, or what he probably just did to make this film, was specifically for the symbolism and the meaning, not the plot. So I think that's why the plot stuff went first when it got cut for the theatrical. But that's just a guess, because I mean that's the stuff that was added back, you know, the main plot, which was
and even without the additional material he added back into the director's cut, I mean the first time I watched this movie I was confused after watching the theatrical cut, but there's enough there. I think it was almost more fun to watch the theatrical cut the first time, because you've got a lot more questions, and you think about it a lot harder. There's enough there in the theatrical cut where you could watch it and you could go, okay, I understand that Donnie went through all this, so that he could, travel back in time and sacrifice himself to save the world. There's enough there in the theatrical version to understand that much. But you don't understand a lot of the rest of it.
Well, and see, I thought the ending was completely, that's not what I walked away with from the ending. I get that, and I get that Donnie Darko in a lot of ways is sort of a Christ figure, and if you follow mm-hmm. all of the religious imagery in the film, then mm-hmm. that's definitely one way of interpreting it. I mean, I kind of took the ending as, you know, he died. And the 28 days that he had were really his being in limbo to kind of sort of heal, or, you know, realize that he was going to go on to the afterlife alone and that he had to kind of fess up to all these things that he had done to people or fess up to whatever crimes he thought he had maybe committed against people. That's kind of what I got out of it.
Yeah, see, I was looking at him as a hero and not
I think both things work. That's what I'm saying.
Either way,
you look at that ending, it makes sense. Like, what I mean? It's not. It's just how you interpret it. I thought this movie was so cool.
Well, Phil, you may not be a big comic book guy, but so let me give you this hint. If you are a comic book character and your name is Donnie Darko, the odds are you're not going to end up as a hero. Now, just ask Dr. Doom.
But there's a difference there, Mike, is that... In like classic literature, obviously the name of the character isn't as important, but a lot of them, just the everyman that's stuck in a weird situation and whatever. And you could argue that this, based off, if this was a short story or a novel by one of those 1950s sci-fi authors, Darko's character fits perfectly with a lot of them as this hero or dark anti-hero that, or not, let me rephrase that, a bright anti-hero. And so they're flawed people who are over and above the norm in a good way, I think. So I know you were just trying to be facetious with the name and stuff. I mean, though.
Well, but again, this is where I would go more. I would maybe anti-hero, but I'd be really careful about calling him a hero because, again, he doesn't necessarily do things that are heroic until you get to the end of the film. He shoots Frank because he's pissed he ran over his girlfriend. But it was not in any way justified. He burned down the guy's house because the guy was a dick.
Yeah, but you're looking
not because he was a pedophile.
You're looking at the term hero in the old-fashioned way, which is, you know, the Dick Tracy and the Superman. While I'm looking at the hero as like Holden Caulfield or Quentin Compson. So we're both looking at the definition of hero completely different then, because I think your hero version is the crap, and I don't mean as an insult directly to you, Mike. I mean it's the fact that, you know, we make Cal Ripken the baseball god, and it's like, if you look at his numbers, good. Derek Jeter the baseball, you know what I'm saying? So it's
I have a couple things to say here. First is that I keep referencing the commentaries, but I really do think they're worth listening to. That there is an intention to have Donnie Darko be kind of a superhero, because he does have superpowers in this movie. There's one point where they discover an axe embedded in the statue of the school's mascot in front of the school. Donnie did that. He had a much above average strength in order to bury an axe into stone. So there was an intention on the part of the creator for that. And then Mike, you were saying that Donnie shot Frank because he was pissed that he killed his girlfriend, and you're right. But at the same time, it falls into the whole mythos that's being created here about the manipulated dead, because if Donnie had not shot Frank, Frank couldn't be the manipulated dead to go back and tell Donnie what to do to save the world. So it's kind of a whole cycle.
That's fortuitous. It was never intent, right? It's a happy accident. It's serendipity.
I don't know.
Not necessarily, Mike. If you look at this whole time loop, whatever, it wasn't an accident.
Well, and circles
from his perspective, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, he did not shoot Frank in order to send him back in time to get him to that point where his girlfriend died. Any more than Frank, if you're going to excuse him shooting Frank, well, you have to excuse Frank for running over the girlfriend.
Well, and Frank is also the one that comes to him and tells him to write a letter to Grandma Death. And that's why Grandma Death is in the middle of the road when Frank swerves the car to kill the girlfriend. So Frank, in a manner of speaking, sets up his own death for the greater good of the universe, I suppose. Right.
You know, the circles could also be symbols, now that you guys are talking about this chicken egg thing.
Uh-huh.
The circles could also work as a reinforcement of that whole idea.
Well,
of
and
the
I,
time
I,
travel thing, where it's just
yeah,
like
I was
going to
say something
cycle.
About
yeah.
that earlier, but it got, I didn't get a chance to chime in.
Yeah, that's cool too, that it could also work that way. But no, what I was just going to say about heroes in general, I think that our modern version of hero has very much morphed over the years with our morphing of the way our society has changed and things have changed.
Chrissy, if I could interject for a second,
yeah,
I would say that's been that way for over 130 years, because, you know, you got Upton Sinclair in the book The Jungle with the Lithuanian immigrant. And all the way, so and that was 100 years ago. You know, Holden Caulfield was 70 years ago or 60 years. You know what I'm saying? So,
right. But what I'm saying is, I think that we have because there's more media to express this now, it's more widespread. That's what I'm saying. Not everybody in the world has read the comic books or Upton Sinclair or, you know what I mean? But yeah. Films get it out. The media that we have now, the social media we have now, even what's interpreted as a heroic move, like on social media, is so from the perspective of where you're standing, if that makes any sense at all. It's not that I'm saying dark heroes didn't exist or anti-heroes didn't exist. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that from what is interpreted as a hero now is so based on who's looking at it. It so depends on where you're standing. Whereas in the past, it was like, this is defined as an anti-hero, this is defined as a hero. Now it's like, well, gee, you know, he stole the bread. It's the whole he stole the bread to feed his family thing. Like, what's really right? Where that's what I'm talking about. It's not necessarily a hero thing. It's a moral thing. Like, it depends on
where you're standing. But he didn't kill Frank to save the universe. He killed Frank because he was upset at Frank.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Also, you got to remember, Mike, the universe was using Donnie as the avatar.
As the tool.
Yeah, that's sort of.
Yeah, but the hammer isn't the builder. Then the universe is the hero, not Donnie Darko.
Okay, you're starting to make sense now.
All right, I see your point a little bit. Yeah. All right.
Now at the end, I mean, and at the end, he makes choices at the very end. When it all comes together to him because he's read the book.
He could have just run out of the room again.
Right. So I'm not saying he doesn't in the end make a heroic act, but he's not. But he does an awful lot of stupid shit in the film because he just does stupid shit because he's a teenager.
That's fair enough.
And because he's human.
But a lot of heroes, Mike, especially the heroes that I'm discussing versus, you know, the Superman, Dick Tracy. My heroes are the flawed people. The everyday.
I'm not saying it's a problem that it's flawed. I'm saying most of the acts that you're, like, cheering on, like burning the house down, he didn't burn the house down because the guy was a pedophile.
He burned the house down because a creepy rabbit dude told him to.
Right. Which is what's going to get him into an institution where they're going to feed him placebos all day long.
But if you look at this film as a fable,
he still burned the burned it down because he was being a selfish little prick.
I see where you're coming from, Mike, but you're not looking at it deep enough. You have to look at it as a
well, no, because now you're being Patrick Swayze telling me that I have to be on the emotional continuum between fear and love. And I'm telling you that he's just a selfish prick for a lot of the film.
And shove it up your anus.
That's right. That's what I was about to say to Eric. That's what I say to you, Mike. Shove it up your anus.
And getting back to the idea that, like, he was dead, you know what I mean? When I said that maybe the ending was just that he actually died and he had to atone for all these things, he finds the wallet in the street after the whole thing where he gets the card on the love fear continuum and he says, well, it's a wallet, like, you know, which comes right before the shove it up your ass thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, if you, he may not have actually been a hero, he may just have been, because there's this whole thread in the movie too about everyone dies alone. I think stressed in a several different ways in the movie.
I think everybody is right. I think Mike is right.
Yeah, I think this is one of those movies where everybody's right. I seriously freaking do. Nobody's wrong. Like, this movie's just got it all. You know?
Throughout the movie, he's certainly guilty of being a stupid teenager. And after everything is said and done at the end of the movie, he realizes what he needs to do and sacrifices himself to save the universe.
That's right. Fight the power.
Well, actually, he embraces the power because the power is the universe. Remember, he has that whole conversation throughout the film. You're having that conversation about God, right? Mm-hmm. Is there a higher power? Is there not a higher power?
Right.
I'm mad as hell.
And in turn, and what happens? He ends up being manipulated by the universe to basically save the universe, to save itself.
He was chosen by the universe. Mm-hmm.
Regardless, he basically has to. He then and kind of ends up coming down on by embracing it and allowing himself to follow those manipulations.
Well, and at the end of the movie, when they're rewinding time, and you see the camera's going back up to the stairs to his room. There's a voiceover of the letter that he wrote to Roberta Sparrow, Grandma Death, and he says, "Dear Roberta Sparrow, I've reached the end of your book, and there are so many things that I need to ask you. Sometimes I'm afraid what you might tell me. Sometimes I'm afraid you'll tell me that this is not a work of fiction. I can only hope that the answers will come to me in my sleep. I hope that when the world comes to an end, I can breathe a sigh of relief because there will be so much to look forward to."
Right. There you go.
See, and to me, that was a metaphor for death, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because the world comes to an end. It's your world that's ending and what lies beyond it. And getting back to that whole thing about, is there a God? Is there a higher power? Where do we go? You know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, that's where I saw the death part of it.
Well, and he definitely does die.
Yeah.
He does.
Well, and I do love that thing at the end. Was that in the theatrical version?
Are you talking about
Gretchen
the Mad World?
On the bike, where Gretchen is on the bike and comes by the house?
Yeah, she raves to the mother.
Okay.
Yeah, let's just talk about that last scene because
I thought that was really interesting because I was almost wondering. Yeah,
the whole last sequence there, with the acoustic cover of Mad World, and then the montage of everybody, because of course there's another snippet from the book to explain it in the director's cut, but you don't get that in the theatrical version, and everybody's waking up and. I don't think anybody clearly remembers what happened in the tangential universe, but they have a notion, right?
Right.
So the therapist wakes up and is probably thinking about Donnie, and then we cut to Patrick Swayze, who's just sitting on his bed sobbing uncontrollably because he knows he's a piece of shit. And then we cut to the gym teacher, who's woken up in the bed and has a look on her face like she might have a notion that Patrick Swayze is a piece of shit. And then we pan over. I can't remember if it's Trita or Frank we see first, but we see Trita in her bed kind of smiling. And then we see Frank in his room. And he's been in the process of designing his rabbit costume, and he kind of reaches up towards his eye that got shot out, even though he's alive again. And eventually we cut to the jet engine and Donnie Darko's body getting hauled out of Darko's house and his family's reactions to his death. And then Gretchen coming up on her bike as they take the jet engine away on a flatbed. And that whole sequence, it really moves me every time I watch it. Just because it's a little ambiguous and at the same time quite moving. And then at the very end, what Christy was referring to, this interaction where Gretchen pulls up on her bike and is asking the kid about it, "Hey, what happened here?" And he's like, "My neighbor's name is Donnie Darko. He got killed in a tragic accident. And did you know him?" And she says, "No, I didn't." But she seems kind of unsure.
Yeah, I really loved the subtlety. I was almost looking for it to see if there was maybe a flash in her eyes. And it almost was there, which would have been too obvious if it had been there, but it wasn't. You know, it was like there and not, and I thought that was so well acted, so well done.
And then she looks over and makes eye contact with Donnie's mom, and the two of them just kind of share a moment, and I don't think either of them quite understands, but they wave at each other, and then that's the end of the movie. So that last sequence there, I just think is masterful, and it's really probably the number one reason I like this movie so much, because no matter how many times I watch it, that last sequence always gets to me.
But why, Eric? Why does it get to you? What makes it important?
Because at the same time, that Donnie, with his trip through the tangential universe, kind of fulfills his destiny by sacrificing himself, watching everybody else when they wake up, like from a dream that they can't quite remember. There's a notion, at least to me, that the people, the manipulated living, as they're called by the book in this movie, have been affected by the creation and destruction of the tangent universe, and kind of have a little bit more of a notion of what's going on, and that everybody's fate isn't finalized, and that the gym teacher can stop pushing his bullshit on her kids, and Patrick Swayze can stop being a piece of shit and peddling kiddie porn if he wants to, and everything's going to be all right for Charita, and Frank's not going to die. It just gives this whole notion that everything's not written in stone, and ultimately do have control of your own destiny.
Yeah, and I think that sequence really spoke to me, because it was a universal acknowledgement of a certain kind of loss and grief that nobody can really put their fingers on, but we all understand. You know, like when she gives the mother that sad wave and the mother sort of waves back, even though mm-hmm. she doesn't know her. Mm-hmm. It's like an acknowledgement of we are all on this journey together. And it's always, there's always going to be something sad. And there's always going to be something that we regret. That's the other thing. I got the sense that each of these characters at the end, except for maybe Charita, had a regret about something. But like you said, you nailed it. They couldn't quite put their finger on it. Mm-hmm. And I also thought what was interesting is that it's almost a comment too, as you were talking about our fates are not written in stone, about how when we change something in our lives, we will never know how, if we had made a different choice, how things would have turned out.
Well,
and I know that that's a comment that's made in a lot of movies like Back to the Future and all this other stuff, but and all these other films and a lot of books and fiction certainly deals with it too. But I think in this movie, it was a very subtle statement. It wasn't like, oh, see how the whole world would be different if this person didn't die, or it was just very, very subtle. And I really liked that. I thought it was very well done.
Well, see, and that's, maybe it's because of everyone talking about the 13 ways, or whatever it is, the 13
reasons why.
13 reasons why, is that he didn't have to die, right? I mean,
right.
He could
chose to.
He chose to. And, you know, well, what is that saying? I mean, why did he choose to die?
To save everybody else.
No, he didn't have to. Everybody was saved.
No, because if he didn't suicide, then the world would dissolve, disappear, because that's what Roberta Sparrow said.
No.
That was the implication according to the time travel book.
Yes.
Why? Well, see, I was reading something and nothing would have changed if he had just rolled out of the bed, right? But the key act was sending the engine, right? Wasn't that sending the engine back to the main universe?
Yes.
Right? So he did that. Mission accomplished. The universe was saved. He didn't have to stay standing underneath, or like, he just chose to roll over and stay there where the plane engine was going to crash on top of him.
You know, okay, that's an interesting point.
And this is something I got from reading online last night, not necessarily.
Yeah.
So not something I picked up on my first run through. But yeah, he embraced dying, and maybe it's a matter of not being clear exactly on where the rules are. And I saw some people suggest that Sparrow was, that was her name, right?
Sparrow,
the woman wrote
Sparrow.
Yeah.
Right, she had been him before, that she had been, what was the name of the character again, the central figure?
Yeah.
I can't remember what it was called either.
Oh, damn it, neither can I right now.
All
right,
but yeah. she had been the one chosen to stop another tangent universe previously, which is how she knows all these rules.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the case, then yeah, there would be an argument that the death is a voluntary thing. And is, I mean, and so in a weird way, it's saying that, gee, we'd all just have been better off if Donnie Darko died. which is a little depressing. It's why I kind of wanted to see, like you mentioned, the Tarita, Cheetah. Mm-hmm. Because they don't show what I wanted to see, which was how does she react when she finds out Donnie Darko dies?
Oh, okay.
Right? We just see her wake up and she's smiling. We don't know why, because we have no reason to believe that the shitty things that are going to be said and done to her over the next couple of days still won't happen, because all it is generic schoolyard bullying. Mm-hmm. But she had a crush on Donnie. Donnie was nice to her. Donnie tried to get some kids to stop picking on her, and now he's gone. What would her response have been to that?
No, your point about Roberta Sparrow is really interesting, though, Mike, because...
Which, again, is not my point, but...
I understand that's not your point, but it's what I found more interesting. Which is that... if she did this before, it gives more credence to the whole... your fate's not written in stone, because Noah Wiley's character early in the movie talks about how one day... she used to go to church every Sunday, and then one day she just woke up and stopped going to church and started teaching science and wrote a book about time travel. And clearly was whatever happened influenced her significantly, and if she went through the same thing that Donnie did, then that would certainly explain it.
Yeah, that's... I'm not really sure again what the film is necessarily trying to say, and again it's all partly because of the convoluted rules. I know what was happening with Marty McFly. I know what was happening with Bruce Willis in 12 Monkeys.
But he was a Christ. He's a Christ figure.
Well, he didn't
back. But, and I also think Mike might have a valid point that he didn't necessarily need to die. That's damn it. Just when I thought I had this movie figured out. I'll have to watch it again now.
Well, and weirdly enough, by not explaining the rules in the theatrical cut, they make it easier probably to believe that he had to die,
mm-hmm.
because he did. And so you just assume you're just kind of rolling with it as they make it up as they go along. And as they start spelling out the rules, then you can start debating what were the rules actually were. Right, and what they fit. And if that's the case, well, again, that to me, that kind of changes how the film plays.
Yeah.
If he chooses to die instead of being forced to... let me phrase that. Chooses to die unnecessarily, as opposed to choosing to die just as a sacrifice.
Necessarily. Gotcha.
Well, good question. I don't know. I mean, it's... I had answers for all this stuff 11 years ago, at least in my interpretation.
Damn it. Why didn't you keep your notes?
I know. I'm like really pissed you didn't keep your notes now. But
now
like
we're going to have to fucking destroy a plane and create a tangential universe for you to go back and get your notes.
Yeah, but hold on. I think truthfully, if Phil is like any of us, what we wrote down 10, 11 years ago that we thought was really profound, we'd look back at it and go, what the fuck was wrong with me?
Well, that's why
Phil,
I was saying...
Phil, find a notebook that has written on the page, Johnny got some!
Saying, little dogs are stupid. What the hell was I writing?
Well, and I think, too, you know, like I said, it just lends credence to the fact that there's a lot to talk about in this movie and that your perception is going to change depending on where you are in your life. And I think what you get out of this movie is going to... be profoundly affected by who you are and where you are in that moment in time in your life.
Well,
I really do.
It could differ depending, I'm pretty sure that my interpretation of this movie after I watched it last night is completely different than my interpretation of the movie after I watched it originally.
Yeah.
I think this is certainly a movie that can be watched multiple times and you take something different away each time.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I do also agree about this is one of the most quotable movies ever. There are just so many great lines in this thing. And in that way, it's kind of fun, too, because, yes, it's dark. Yes, it's got a lot to say. Yes, you have to focus on it. Yes, it's literary, but it still has those really nice moments of fun. You know?
Sparkle
it really
motion.
Does. Yep.
Well, that's an important thing that some people get way too bogged down in being that pretentious douchebaggery, right? In that, I'm being profound here. Yeah. You must pay attention to me because I'm profound. You can have fun with your profundity.
Yes.
Well, and that's what I liked about this movie, too, is that I think we can all agree that we have seen movies that are full of pretentious douchebaggery that are pretentious.
Well, this and to be movie, sure, there's some of that going on in this movie.
Well, some of it, but it's not, I don't think it's overt. To me, pretentious douchebaggery is when you're doing it just for the hell of being pretentious. I don't think that whoever, based on what I watched today, I don't think that that's really what was going on here. I think whoever wrote this and the director or whatever, I think they just, like you said, he never even, from listening to the commentaries, he's not even sure he really knew what he was making. That is not a move by somebody who's trying to make a pretentious film.
Mm-hmm.
When you're trying to make a pretentious film or write a pretentious story, you are busting your ass to make sure it is the most pretentious thing ever.
Let me cut in here. What I meant by pretentious douchebaggery was strictly from a filmmaking point of view. Like, there are several scenes in which he does some very dramatic camera movement and angles. Where he's just trying to show off that he can do that. That's what I meant.
Okay. And that's okay. Then definitely I'm coming from a total story standpoint, not a film standpoint. So I would not pick up on that stuff.
All young filmmakers have that, because there is a certain element of youth that goes with being pretentious.
And this was his first film. So I'm not criticizing him for that. I'm just saying it's there.
Right. And it's,
thank you for listening to the episode. At this point, there was a huge thunderstorm that caused the power to go off. The power remained off for 2 hours, and we could not continue to record. However, after discussing with everyone later, we all decided that we were pretty much done with discussing Donnie Darko, and we could just wrap it up. So this is the wrap-up. Once again, thank you for listening to darkdiscussions.com. You can find us on Twitter, iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, email darkdiscussions@aol.com, and so forth. And until next week, rewatch Donnie Darko. It's a great film, and we will see you then.
Yeah.